As another, as a supporter of the Anal School rather than the Chaps and whatever.
Oh, yeah.
Chaps and Math School.
Yeah.
I don't consider this to be ephemeral. I consider this to be the important stuff of which important historical events are understood.
Good. This is a contract where I'm retained by the administrator of the City of Long Beach as a consultant. Do I need to identify furthermore that it's written by Sam Roberts, S. Sam Roberts, of March 18, 1960? I have a note here that a paper by analysis of stresses causing land subsidence by Lufgren, Geological Survey Research, 1968, and I have a note that it looks a lot of my work in this are similar. I see. They have a name for this. This was a release, a general release.
A press packet?
Huh?
Press packet?
Yes. This is a press packet. And if you read, it's in a black folder, and it's general release, Long Beach Subsidence Control and Dedication of Water Injection Pumping Plant, October 29th.
Good.
Well, your box is pretty full.
Yes. But I have another, so don't worry. I didn't want to seem over anxious and come with two.
Well, I don't want to. This is a study of the speed of sound and porous granular media. Brandt, California Research, fact. Again, this has to do with the susceptibility, vulnerability to consolidation. Paper by fact. He is sound. Overburden pressure relative permeability. He is sound man. This is not one bit derivative, and he is an honored professor at Berkeley and did work for the federal government on what happened to the ground around the subsurface nuclear explosions.
Mm.
World largest water flood. Western Oil and Refining Magazine, 1960. I hate to be derogatory, and I don't believe that they're still in the business, but this McCord and Associates, May 1958, Practical Subsidence, I think is just twaddle, just absolute twaddle. This, in its day, wasn't important. Hudson, Study of Subsidence, Long Beach Harbor Area, Frank Hudson, 56. He was well recognized. I don't, it's really kind of derivative and it's talky, and I don't admire it. I admire my own.
Okay, that's good.
This belongs in the set. It happens to be horizontal, strain, surface. Swabini, and I'm looking at Ranger Zone core samples under simulated triaxial loading and reservoir temperature during producing conditions. I'm looking, and this is all University of Southern California, Handy's the top of the department, Chillinger, Van Zandt. And I think it must have virtues. I never spent much time. I'm not derogatory. I'm just kind of ignorant. Here is more of the fire rating, a bigger treatment of the fire rating. Very solid and important material. This is a follow-up on casing joint measurement, collarcount. And they kept doing it for 15 years. Well, they still do a little bit, and that would make it. The first collarcount was around 1949 and 50, and that would make it 33 years. And some are still going on. For instance, here's collar logging, 71. Here's the tool development, 67, again, for collar count. Might say that precision collar in radioactive bullet measurements, precision collar is collar count, collar and radioactive bullets. I don't think I'm offering you very much here, but maybe if somebody was really eager, they could get a hold of a thesis, probably is in better than this god-awful Thermofax, of major subject geology of 58, and it's going on in A&M, Texas. I think that does make the cut. And when I've become better cleared, well, I'll have more material. Library that I can imagine a scholar traveling many miles to study in the law section of the subsiding library. It really is a lot of kind of rare stuff that didn't make the academic journals. Should have, but it didn't.
Yeah, and it's wonderful to have you explain what it means, because before we just had what Daryl Naver said about it, and he doesn't really understand the technical aspects of what all those titles mean. And you've made them sort of all come together for me. I mean, as far as I can understand, which is not terribly far.
Well, if I was worth my salt, I would write my version of what I'm calling the seven pillars of wisdom, those books which are absolutely necessary, fundamental to the basic knowledge, science, and what happened in subsidence, the source books, the most important source books. And I imagine that sometime in history that somebody will pop up and say they wish to be a student of subsidence. Well, they possibly could read my introductory to the seven volumes. By the way, the Seven Pillars of Wisdom was T.E. Lawrence, part of Revolt in the Desert.
Yeah.
How about that? I've forgotten his allusion, why he came up with the seven pillars of wisdom, but it just happened to come to mind when I saw seven, so I said, seven important.
What about the politics of society? How were you affected by that? One of the things that comes to mind is that you had your ego and your talk, and you said you went on and talked to a community group.
On community groups, I was led, conducted, conveyed by either Elwha Amar or not Frosty Martin, but Shoemaker, other city politicians who, having received a phone call from the Lions Club, or the Merchants Club, I remember, on the Bixby Knolls. They took me along and they made a short introduction, and I entertained the assembled people. The one on Atlantic for the Bixby Knolls killed me. Something was completely wrong with the agenda, because finally they called on me. I swear it was 10:30 or a quarter to 11, and everybody's fanny was sat out. Absolutely, they looked at me glassy-eyed, said, "Oh, no." And I said, "Well, I guess I better do something." So rather than my usual 15, 20 minutes or something, I did something in 3 minutes, thinking that I was their savior. And when I got back to the office, got back to the Harbor Department, Maddie, have you ever heard of Maddie? He was a long time secretary to the Board of Harbor Commissioners. I told him, I said, "If you masterminded that and have worked out so neat to be called on at a quarter of 11, where everybody's sitting there from Christ's sake, from dinner there." I remember that anyway. I was invited to Caltech by, of all people, Richter, because Richter was interested in these shears. I would phone him. I phoned him. I said, "Have you felt anything?" And he would say, "I'll go look." And remember, we had one in 47, one in 49, and one in 51. And they were all unique in that most earthquakes have a deep. Earthquakes in California occur at a depth of 10 miles, and a certain kind of wave goes out in another. Well, this was a unique slide, not a real earthquake, but it was unique in the annals. So he invited me to talk to the geology club at Caltech. Darrell Neighbors invited me to what was some serious big assemblies of the Chamber of Commerce of Long Beach, some of which meetings and my lecture had consequences. It influenced people. I talked to graduate students at Stanford and Berkeley on a kind of a trip, because one or the other invited me. I've forgotten if one invited me, I told the other one they should invite me or something rather horrid, but I did talk to two of them. And that was the nature. I would say the most I gave them to was by virtue of being escorted by members of the Board of Harbor Commissioner and members of the Oil Department of the Board of Harbor Commissioners, all of whom were looking for civic support in unitization and in whatever people look to support by the citizenry.
So this is before injection was really implemented?
Oh, yes, before unitization. Unitization was a big hurdle in that there were so many people who resisted. Unitization is the same as collectivism, where the farmer, kulak, gives up his individual farm and becomes an employee for a big farming organization. In the case of unitization, the individual operator gives up operation and he takes a small percentage of the total big pie and has given up his nurturing of these oil wells that he drilled and gave his life blood for, and they resisted. Well, legislature in Sacramento passed a mandatory unitization, which limited to the threat of inundation the state could call for the involuntary, mandatory unitization. Once you have unitization, you can inject oil in the ground, because without unitization, as long as you have lease boundaries, you inject water into A, and it sweeps the oil from A into B. And that is defies legality and your royalty owners and your own oil. So you can't push water across property lines, oil and water, as long as they are truly defined mineral boundaries. But where you have unitization and have given up your identity in these particular four or five wells and taken a 10% or a 5% of the whole big pie, that's unitization. Well, in order to get that through Congress, in order, I guess, to please public opinion, that you weren't, the Harbor Department wasn't just shoving people around, and Long Beach Oil Development wasn't just shoving people around, why there was this part of this public relations effort. And I gave lectures as part of that drive, which resulted in mandatory unitization and made injection possible. And the big thing was that they were saving the city of Long Beach from sinking beneath the sea.
You said there was something
between
you that, like, people's minds
were changed? It was. Qualified observers told me that following a big meeting of the Chamber of Commerce, where Darrell Neighbors was the chairman, there was a big, big room, big general meeting, and I had my easel and talk papers, and I drew an outline of the total field, as yet undeveloped, East Wilmington, which is now Thumbs. And I pointed out that the value, the then dollar value, of those reserves were over $3 billion. I then had, and I quoted from a Chamber of Commerce listing of the assets of the city of Long Beach, and the tax roll assets, not churches and not streets and not city, but the tax roll assets, the total city of Long Beach was less than the $3 billion. And I said, now we in the oil industry have expenses when we produce oil. We have to take care of roads and chop down weeds and do other things besides just producing oil. And I said, as far as we can see, that since the assets of the total gross assets of the oil exceeds the tax roll of the city of Long Beach, that you are going to have production out there. Nothing is going to stop it. That's the law of nature. People said afterwards, well, I didn't like what you said, Law. I didn't like it. But I'll tell you this, it changed. The people no longer, the people, quite a number of important people, recognized that speech of yours on comparing the total tax roll assets of the city of Long Beach to an oil pool out there and the inevitability of its production, that they recognized that that was faith, and that was what, and it did influence people, and I've been told that you might ask Darrell Neighbors that same question, that was not a big revolutionary turning point, but it did turn a lot of people to say, well, let's get on with it. We better unitize, we better inject water, and we better fight subsidence, because you can't just sit here and say, like King Canute, when he told the tide to not come in. That was the tide in the city of Long Beach, would be a King Canute if they sat there in that chair and said, don't come. It was coming. So that was a... that was a wonderful case you asked about. I, as you know, I'm ambivalent when it comes to ultimate subsidence. And I think there's a great deal to be said on both sides. It is going to stop at 30 feet. It has stopped at 30 feet. And there's something to be said on the other hand that there will be a creepy sort of a low rate of subsidence that could keep on for 1,000 years. And I think that the best answer belongs in the realm of the soil mechanics. And I'm not a soil mechanic, and I have just recently learned a bit of deep-seated humility that I'm sure I needed desperately or needed, in that I sure don't know the answer to it. But I don't think it's a cut and dry by any means.
So, when you first came along and started being interested in society, nobody knew what was going to happen.
And that Stanford Research Institute,
yeah.
One thing about it that is very nice, it goes through the, what were thinking people, and Christ knows, Stanford Research Institute had thinking people and talked to thinking people. What were the options? What were the alternatives? Could it be in the aqueous phase of the first 1,500 feet? And there was reason to believe it could be there. What were the reasons that it could be for and against in the oil field? So that Stanford Research is a beautiful, like the opening acts of a play or an opera or something, where they set the, what was the status, what were people thinking, what were they being torn between this and that. That Stanford Research sets that atmosphere. And some of the red herring, some of the false sense that got people going were beautifully done. The best example was with the Pearl Harbor, the United States Navy started to put in the graving dock. That's 1,100 feet long, 150 feet wide, about 150 feet deep. And in order to work dry to put in this mammoth concrete coffin, they put well points down and had to pump the water out. And when they got down there, they got the gravelly bed of the Gaspar Aquifer. Parenthetical expression. If you want to find I'm digressing.
Okay.
If you, being a historian, want to find out how the Gaspar Aquifer ever got the name Gaspar, being a gravelly bed, and as you know, most of the time a bed is named after the owner of the property in which a first well penetrated and discovered it. So there has to be a Mr. Gaspar or a Mrs. Gaspar around Long Beach or up the river, Cerritos Channel, that had a Mr. Gaspar. Well, when they dewatered that, they pumped millions of barrels of water, because this gravelly had a terrific volume, and they pumped out million barrels a day. Something extraordinary. They caused a localized bowl of subsidence right around the graving dock in which the casing protruded. In my speech I tell you about, and if there's a shallow aquifer, and this consolidated while the casing protrudes, well, all the casing protruded, and there were oil people there who saw to it, it was measured, they understood it, they said the groundwater regime has fundamentally offered by this mammoth dewatering, and they knew to their dying day that water caused, because this illness, disease, that was started by the dewatering of the graving dock, same way spread out, so you formed a bigger bowl. And they had concrete evidence that a bowl of subsidence was awfully close to the eventual, and that water caused it, because any food could finally sink that the cause and effect between the dewatering, the makeup. Now, those people were like, you know, like a chorus, a Greek chorus. They would always come in, yah, but. That was dewatering and wasn't oil. Other kinds of false thing, and I subscribe to this. The oil field in Wilmington is made up of various blocks, fault blocks, with faults. And the faults had been moved on within geologic history, within the relatively recent twice the same Pliocene, so on. And that as we produced them, we produced fault box 3 and dropped the pressure down while fault box 2 and fault box 4 were still up the pressure. Well, any fool can plainly see that if consolidation was taking place inside of 3 and not taking place in fault box 4 and fault box 2 contiguous with the common fault, that you would have to shear wells at those points where the casing penetrated the plane of the fault. The thing called would have to move. It's a lovely idea. It just wasn't so one bit. It didn't work that way. The consolidation would never take place, and there was very little movement on a fault, even though there were very large differences in pressure and pressure reduction and tendency to consolidation, but they didn't move on the fault. There was one called a harbor entrance fault that finally, oh my goodness, in the 60s, sheared 3 or 4 wells somewhat. But there was an example of my well-intentioned reasoning, which just wasn't so, we found out. And subsidence attracted the nuts. There were all kinds of ridiculous solutions given by people who found it exciting, were not trained, and at least that created a diversion and a diversion and a failure to concentrate on. People were preoccupied. Certain amount, I guess, just listening to the nuts rather than concentrating.
Are there any other things I could ask you about the political aspects of society? And was that your basic contribution with going out and trying to tell people what was going on?
Well, contribution, yes. I was never asked to go to Washington, D.C. to talk this or that for legislation, or never asked to go to Sacramento to talk, lobby for this or that legislation. The only thing I might say is based upon the fact that I grew up reading the Muckrakers when I was 10, 12, 14. My mother was an office holder in the League of Women Voters. I was aware of deficiencies, and as I say, the most glaring example to me of the lack of, I don't know whether it's morality or ethics or the propagation of justice, maybe, is that when the United States Navy just settled out of court and didn't face up to it, what caused subsiding, unless have it out in the open and settle it, because it isn't going to go away just because the Navy made a temporary settlement of convenience. I think that was a serious lack of the pursuit and propagation of justice and knowledge, because nobody else was big enough, independent enough, to do what the Navy could have done. But, as Calvin Coolidge says, the business of the United States is business. And that was an excellent example. The United States Navy, or the Department of, who would it be above them, the War Department, weren't interested in the propagation of knowledge and justice in a little corner of Southern California.
One of the things that I thought about when I was listening to your tape over is that you said when you were learning to be a consultant that the other geological and